very attractive, vigorous young Congressman Don Irwin. And as you know, and current, other distinguished Democrats, including my old friend John Bailey. I'm delighted to be in Stamford again, I think for the second time this year. The first time I had no idea that I'd be in the kind of trouble I'm in today. Nevertheless, I was happy to be here then and delighted to be here now. Especially with Abe Ribicoff. I think there's something symbolic about this. I got to know Abe for the first time in 1954, when we were both running for governor in our respective states. Our election was early in September when I won, and his was in November when he won. We both won upset victories in 1954. I hope that means something for 1968. You notice this beautiful flying over Connecticut, coming down from Boston this morning. Fall foliage, although it's past its peak, is still very colorful from the air. And I never enjoyed more the Connecticut valleys and lakes and streams in their setting of fall foliage. It was really striking. It was a great day to start, another day of campaigning. You know, the other day I picked up a story that I'd like to share with you. This is the story of an elderly man years ago out in Whittier, California, who was strolling along the streets when a young boy came barreling around the corner and ran pell-mell into him. So he asked the young fellow, "What's the rush?" Well, the youngster said, "I'm trying to stop two kids from being in a fight." Well, the old fellow said, "Well, who are the boys and where are they?" Well, the boy said, "I'm one of them." The young man said, "What's your name?" He said, "Dick Nixon." I read something in the Wall Street Journal this morning about Mr. Nixon. Strange thing, the subjects that we get preoccupied with in election years this year, but this had to do with Mr. Nixon's makeup problem. You recall something about that from 1960. Well, this Wall Street Journal article says that Mr. Nixon's perspiration problem is the worst he's ever seen. His staff apply antiperspirants to his face before he goes on camera. They also give him a handkerchief soaked in the chemicals so he can mop his brow with it during TV appearances. Even so, he is still sweating a lot. I wonder if that's got anything to do with our movement in the polls these last two or three days. Another thing I think I enjoyed most was the comment of Mr. Fiorentino, his lighting expert. Mr. Fiorentino says this: "We can't make Nixon look like Ronald Reagan, but we can make him look as good as Nixon can." Well, even the Wall Street Journal can be amusing at times. I thoroughly enjoyed this opportunity of traveling around the country, meeting Americans everywhere. And the thing that reassures me about it all is the realization, after I've met so many of them in so many different places, in the cities, in the country, in the west, in the east, north and south, black and white, is that we are still one country. without all our problems, all our divisions, all our troubles, all our disagreements. We are still basically one country of Americans who want to understand each other, who want to like each other, who want to cooperate with each other, and who want to work together to make a greater country tomorrow than we've known today. It's this whole feeling of wanting to trust one another, in spite of the fact that it's difficult to do so in the turbulent times of 1968. The basic desire to try to build something better, to which Democrats have always tried to appeal in the 180-year history of our country. And so it has been reassuring to know that I can talk to people in New Mexico or Texas or Arkansas or North Carolina or Georgia in exactly the same way, appealing to the same instincts, spelling out the same goals that I used to when I was running for governor and for senator in my own state. And so as I talk with people all over this country, I am confirmed in my conclusion that this campaign involves the conservation of America, the conservation of our natural resources, the enrichment of our institutions, the fulfillment of our people, because America does belong to the people who inhabit it. Each thinking, caring, believing American man and woman must work, beginning this year, to preserve it. We must work to conserve our natural resources, as we must work to make America safe, to make America just. The United States has undergone 200 years of continuous change and dramatic development. And today we have the most technologically advanced nation in the world. But in the process, our air and water resources have been degraded. The public health and welfare has been endangered. The landscape has been scarred and littered. And the quality of our national life has been jeopardized. During the 1950s, Democratic Congresses struggled to expand pollution control programs against the opposition of a Republican administration which sought to leave this responsibility at the state and local level, and against the opposition of an administration which vetoed a bill to increase our water pollution control investment from a pitiful $50 million a year to an almost as pitiful $90 million a year. Their interests, presumably at the expense of the buyer's interest in his administration. This all represents a philosophy of let the buyer beware. I don't think this attitude is responsible. I don't think it reflects our consumer needs in the year 1968, and it is a far cry from the actions of the Democratic Party during the last 4 years. Actions not just to right specific wrongs, but to make the federal government a responsive, concerned defender of the rights consumers must have, to know what they're buying, and to be protected against injury and fraud. If the American dream is not the exclusive property of any one political party, I submit that the Democratic Party has been the chief instrument of orderly progress in our time. And we know, because experience has taught us, that America builds best when it is called upon to build greatly. John Kennedy gave us that call to greatness in 1960, President Johnson promised to continue his efforts to achieve that goal 5 years ago. and the Democratic platform of this year, Mr. Humphrey and I, as well as Abe Ribicoff and Don Irwin, are pledged to a continuation of the struggle to make America a stronger country, to make America a freer country, to make America a better place in which to live, to make America a place which understands that in order to ensure the same kind of lives for our children, we must conserve our resources, use them more wisely, and establish a government of law, creating a climate of opportunity for all citizens to make wise decisions, sure decisions, in the marketplace, in the ballot box, in our voting places, and in government itself. That's the direction we think America ought to move. We ask your help in making that possible. And I think we're going to get your help between now and Election Day. And with that help, we're going to rack up another one of those victories that Abe Ribicoff and I began in 1954. Thank you very much.
The Humphrey and Musk administration planned to do with General Hershey and planned to do with the Selective Service Law and the system.
Well, with respect to General Hershey, I don't think the campaign is the place to begin hiring and firing people. We'll take that problem under consideration when we get there. With respect to the draft, I've made several speeches on this subject, as has the Vice President. I'll be glad to summarize our views. First of all, we favor the lottery system of selecting people for the draft. Secondly, we think that young men ought to be subject to the draft or vulnerable to selection only in their 19th year rather than from 18 to 26, as under the present law, in order to enable them to plan their lives more effectively. Thirdly, and these provisions are subject to review as we build a new draft policy, my present view is that a young man, if selected at the age of 19, has the option of taking 2 years of college at that time, not as an exemption, but simply as a postponement of his service obligation. I think, in addition, that we need to strengthen the administration of the selective service system from the top down without making reference to personalities. First of all, we need to develop national guidelines for the 4,000 local draft boards. They operate under national policies, but their application of those policies, especially with respect to college student deferments, varies greatly and I think ought to be made more uniform in order to establish more equal justice under these regulations. Secondly, about one-fifth of the local draft boards of the membership are over 70. I think that ought to be corrected. Next, only 1.3% of the membership of local draft boards are Negroes. I think that ought to be corrected. The appeals procedures need to be strengthened. The draft registrant ought to be given more adequate notice of his status in sufficient time to take advantage of the appeals procedure if he desires to do so. His rights under appeal ought to be made clear to him, and he ought to be given sufficient time to decide whether or not to take advantage of them. These are some of the reforms that we think would be constructive and consistent with our needs for manpower in our armed forces.
Senator Muskie, everyone agrees that your growing popularity is due to your candor, honesty, respect for dissenters, and sense of justice. Would you please tell us local Democrats about the necessity of these virtues in order to reunite the party? Because today we notice that there are some town officials who are not on the platform.
Well, I don't know that we could get anyone else. I really can't answer that question. I'm not much of a preacher.
Senator Muskie.
And I don't know what your reference to local officials means, but we've been warmly welcomed this morning by all kinds of local leaders, mayors, congressmen, Senator Ribicoff, John Bailey. And I was very happy about it until you asked your question.
Senator Muskie, we have a question over here.
Yes.
Senator Muskie, I have two questions. The first one is, do you think that the current lull in the fighting in Vietnam is an authentic signal from the North Vietnamese that they're ready to enter into serious negotiations? Or do you agree with Curtis LeMay that they're just licking their wounds? And the second part is, as a courageous Senator McCarthy struck out from the tired policies of the past, I think this is a beautiful opportunity for you and for Vice President Humphrey to show that this is a time that you also want to actually separate yourself from these policies. I think that everybody knows that Nixon's policies are essentially the policies of President Johnson, and I think 8 years is long enough. I think the American people have shown that today those policies don't work any longer. I think now is the time for Senator Vice President Humphrey and yourself actually to make your move, and I think on November 5th, you are the only two people that can do anything for this country. Thank you.
Senator Muskie.
Well, I'm not... Oh, wait a minute. I'm not sure whether the second was a question or a speech, but I'll be happy to treat it as a question. You know, on that question of having two questions, I'm reminded of the out-of-stater who stopped in a little town in Maine that was obviously a very pleasant, healthy place to live, and he said, "What's the mortality rate in this town?" And the native said, "One to a customer." Well, let's see. What was your first question?
Whether you think that...
On the law. Well, I've been briefed on what is or is not going on here, and I can't respond to that question without breaching the confidence, which I think has to be respected in this respect. I was given a confidential briefing. That's it. I can't speculate on what it means or what it doesn't mean. Now, with respect to your second question, you say Mr. Humphrey and myself ought to separate ourselves from the previous administration. I suspect you mean that with respect to Vietnam policy. Well, the difficulty here is, one, that no matter what we say, we have no authority, unless on November 5th we are given authority, and even then we have no authority until January 20th. Secondly, we're still hopeful, and this is unrelated to what's going on now because I've been saying it right along, that we can end this war before January 20th. Now, if you want to make some judgment on what the various presidential candidates would be inclined to do on questions of peace and our relations with the rest of the world, we've made many statements on this subject in this campaign, and each of us have a quarter of a century of public life for you to examine. You can examine Mr. Nixon. He was vice president. I think you can get pretty good clues from the 8 years he was vice president as to what his attitude would be. And we've tried in this campaign, without pulling the rug out from under the negotiators in Paris, to give you some clues as to what our basic thrust is toward questions of peace. Sure, it would be nice if all we were dealing with is a problem in a classroom that had no impact upon our national policies or upon our men in South Vietnam to have three different presidential candidates give their views on how they would react to the problem. but this is an actual problem. And we don't want, by anything we say, to jeopardize the toxin Paris so that fighting continues for a day longer than necessary between now and January 20th. That's an inhibiting fact. It inhibits us. It inhibits young people like you who would like to know more about our view. We understand that. But I think it's a very important fact, and we've tried to keep it uppermost in our minds.
Senator Muskie, four.
I'm terribly sorry. Senator Muskie has to appear in New Haven in less than 1 hour, and we certainly do not want to jeopardize his safety. I wish to express a sincere thank you to the Fairfield County Mothers for their
wonderful. Thank you very much, Dick Lee, my good friend Abe Ribicoff, Bob Jaimo, and my good friends up here and down there. I'm delighted to be here in New Haven this afternoon. And I might give a special word of greeting to my friends back here. My brother is an iron worker in California, and I'd like to see California and Connecticut go the same way in this election. You know, the fellas in the union never paid much attention to my brother until I was nominated. Now they've got him campaigning all over the country. You never know what kind of trouble you're going to get your relatives in this political business. Well, we've enjoyed the day in Connecticut. Haven't really worked very hard thus far. Got up at 6:30 and have made only one speech. And didn't expect to make one here. But I'm glad the crowd has gathered. Glad I have the opportunity to say something. You know, years ago, Adlai Stevenson said something about our form of government that it seems to me is highlighted this year as never before. He pointed out that since the beginning of time, governments have been engaged mainly in kicking people around. But the astonishing achievement of the Western world in modern times is that the idea that the citizens should do the kicking. And you young people have shown us this year what kicking really is all about. And I think it's been good for you, and I think it's been good for us. And I think out of this kind of an exchange, we're going to build a different kind of a country. We're going to build a better country. We're going to build a country which has even greater room for opportunity, for young people, for disadvantaged people, for people whoever they are and wherever they live. And I want to say to you that notwithstanding the fact that we've been traveling here for the last 8 weeks as underdogs, given little hope by those who pay no attention to the people themselves, that has been a very reassuring and stimulating and exciting experience. Oh, there are voices of fear raised in the land. There are voices of hatred raised in the land. There are voices of division raised in the land. But this isn't a country which basically responds to that kind of a message. From the beginning of this system of government, our objective has been very clear. We've never achieved it fully. We must still work toward it. But the objective has been clear: to build a society which is truly based not only upon the needs of rank-and-file citizens, but also is responsive to their voice. This was a relatively easy concept to understand in the beginning because we were small. Our population was under 4 million. We were an agrarian society where the individual citizen was more or less in control of his own life, more or less in a position to decide what directions his life would take. Well, in order to govern the kind of a society which we've got now, crowded, almost 200 million people, with the environments in our cities unacceptable to too many Americans as places to live, with too many places in our cities, in our rural areas, without opportunity or without hope for too many Americans, we've had to build great private and public institutions to run a government and a country like this. And in the process, we've forgotten the original purpose, the objective of building them upon the popular franchise, making them responsive to people and making it possible for people to participate. Here in New England, we understood the need for this kind of relationship between the citizen and his institutions because we conceived and developed and still use in the smaller towns of my state and other parts of New England the town meeting form of government. But even that is shrinking and atrophying under the pressures of a complex modern society. Well, this is the big test which the American system must meet. Jefferson understood it. He Tocqueville understood it. They all understood that throughout the history of man, when societies become crowded, when the gap between the affluent and the poor becomes too great, when too many people lose hope, throughout the history of man, this has been the point in time when societies have begun to break down or explode. Well, now we've reached that testing time here in the United States of America in 1968. Our system has worked well up to this point, and really, the federal system is ideally suited. If we'll modify it to modern requirements, it's ideally suited to the kind of responsiveness and participation which we need to make people feel significant in this highly industrialized technological society. And as I travel around the country talking to young people on the campuses, it seems to me that the thing that frustrates them above all else, in addition to the particular issues which concern them, is the apparent impenetrability of the establishment of the institutions which make us operate. Abe Ribicoff and a lot of us who are older here, who went to college in the 30s, who knew the Depression, became preoccupied in that time with what economic insecurity does to inhibit people, to limit their freedom, to limit their opportunity. And so for all this period since, we've been preoccupied with the objective of developing economic growth, economic opportunity, the development of material things. And so we've become a materialistic society, and in the process have forgotten the human values and what they mean. You young people never knew economic insecurity in the sense that we do. You've known the results, whether or not they are the benefits of affluence. And that isn't good enough for you, and it shouldn't be good enough for us. You're interested in intellectual stimulus, spiritual stimulus, opportunities for the spirit and the inner man to grow and to understand other people and to develop understanding and compassion and concern about others. That, as I get it, is what you're interested in, and it's what we ought to be interested in. And we've reached that point in the development of our society when we can afford to be interested in it, but more importantly, we've reached that point in our society when we must be interested in that sort of thing if what we believe America ought to be is to become just that. And that's what we're talking about as we travel across this country. And we understand some of the immediate things that need to be done if we're to get on to this greater task. We've got to end the war, clearly. Yeah! But secondly, and this is very important, to those who are principally preoccupied with that, and I understand the preoccupation, but when we end this war, we're going to have a period of transition from a wartime economy, from wartime priorities, from wartime preoccupation, to the kinds of policies which will decide the shape, the future shape of our society. Bayard Rustin said something in Philadelphia the other day that I'd like to say to you. He's one of the great Negro leaders, and he was speaking at a luncheon meeting to which I was also privileged to speak, of Kennedy and McCarthy people who met together to decide what they would do about this election. And he said this to them. He said, there's no one in America more concerned about the war than I am. But, he said, this election is more important for another reason. He likened it to the election of 1876, which established the basic American attitude toward race relationship from 1876 to this time. And he pointed out that America cannot afford another election of 1876. This must be an election when the American people decide in their own hearts and minds that they must learn to trust other Americans, whoever they are, whatever their color, whatever their origin, wherever they live. We must learn to trust other Americans if we're to make freedom work. There's no other basis upon which freedom can survive. And by trust, I mean you've got to be willing to take the risk that a man you trust will injure you, or that he'll rebuff your friendship, or that he may be an evil man, or that in lashing out at injustice, he hits his friends as well as his enemies. That's the kind of trust which we must have to build a free society in this country. And this is the really important issue of this campaign. And so, as we plan the transition from war to peace, we've got to be concerned about the policies which are to be developed at all levels of government. We must be concerned about the priorities which we'll assign to the use of our great resources. We must ensure that those resources are used to the maximum extent possible to make this a country of opportunity for every American, wherever he is. And that over and above the urgings of ambition, which I suppose prompt all of us. But over and above, this is the reason I feel so privileged to run for vice president in this election campaign. Because I believe this so deeply. It's the kind of thing I've talked about to my people in Maine for 14 years. It's one of the reasons we've been able to build a strong, competitive two-party system with a viable and successful Democratic Party, not as an end in itself, but in order to create a climate in which people can trust themselves, can live together, and work together in peace and justice. That's the only way you can build safety for anybody. That's the only way you can build security for anybody, to build a society in which every citizen has hope for improvement. So I've been delighted with the opportunity to campaign nationally, and I've been reassured that Americans everywhere really want this kind of an America. Whether they live in the cities, in the ghettos, the suburbs, in rural areas, in the east, west, north, or south, this is what every human being who lives under the American flag wants. And this is what we want to make possible. With your help, we can do it. Thank you very much.
WTIC Television.
This cuts both ways. I noticed the Harris poll in the vice presidential race this morning, for example. Only 76% of those who would vote for Humphrey prefer me over Agnew and LeMay. People are that way. They don't all favor the same man. And the second point that you've got to remember is that so far as the national audience is concerned, I'm a new face. Not fresh. At my age, you can't be fresh, but a new face. And so they haven't seen the warts yet, and that's understandable. But I think increasingly, as they concentrate on the presidential choices, that they begin to see them in better focus and better perspective, and I think you're going to see Mr. Humphrey's support rise. And if I contribute to something to that, well, naturally, that's some source of personal satisfaction. You know, I'm just not a spare tire, but a positive asset.
What gives you the impression, Senator, that your ticket is on the upswing? Both Mr. Humphrey and you have indicated that you feel things are going better. What clues do you have that this is happening?
Well, the clues I've always found very reliable in my 14 years of running for office in Maine. You know, you see an awful lot of people. And when you're a candidate running around the country, more than anybody else does, more than any pollster does, more than any political commentator does. And you develop antennae after you've been in this business a long time. Now, my own feeling for about 3 weeks has been that there's a noticeable lift to our campaign. I didn't trust it because I had never run for national office before. But on the basis of what my reaction would have been in a main campaign, I felt things were going well. Well, then last week we had the Gallup poll, the Harris poll, which showed a substantial closing of the gap, and that reinforced my feeling. The Gallup poll today didn't show as much movement, but on the other hand, the Harris vice presidential poll showed a great deal of movement. And so I feel that these are clues of real movement in our direction. Now, whether or not that movement is fast enough, and the time left, peak is the question. And I don't have any better answer for that than you gentlemen do.
You don't think you're ahead now, in other words?
Oh, I don't think we're ahead now. Well, I don't really know, because the most recent poll is based on a survey that's almost 2 weeks old now. So I don't know whether we're not ahead now. But I'd prefer to assume we're not, whatever the actual situation is.
Senator, you've been on the campaign trail now for close to 2 months. From a personal standpoint, how do you feel? Is this a great physical strain for a candidate going on like this for this period of time?
Well, it is, but I've had that before. I found this really the most stimulating experience of my life. I've never felt more at ease or less under pressure. Physically, yes, but in terms of my reaction to it and feeling relaxed, I've never felt better.
In other words, you like it?
I like it. Yes.
Senator, one of the points Mr. Nixon and some other Republicans have made in their attacks upon the Democratic administration is a claim that the poverty program is in trouble, there's money being wasted. And of course, we have in Connecticut an old friend of yours, Congressman Jamo, who also feels that the poverty program, as it applies to his district, has produced a great deal of waste and money going down a rat hole, so to speak. What's your feeling on this? Do you feel that there are some changes to be made by the new administration?
Right now,
and Vice President Hunter.
My feeling about it is like that old one that you've all heard. The fast is partially full of water. You can look at it as half full or half empty, depending upon your point of view. Now, the war on poverty undertook to deal with a problem that man has never solved ultimately in any society. How to get poor people who don't have the skills, who live in surroundings that offer them little hope from their point of view, how to get them to break out of the vicious cycle of poverty from father to son, into a rehabilitated and constructive use in a highly technological and industrial society where there's a premium on skills. This isn't an easy thing to do. Well, the war on poverty has been experimented for that reason. No one knew in advance what approaches would work and which ones wouldn't. There have been some outstanding successes. Head Start is so successful that even Republican members of Congress like it and would like to transfer it from the war on poverty into the regular educational programs so that they could vote against the rest of the war on poverty while supporting this one, you see. Upward Bound, that program to get youngsters from deprived backgrounds onto an equal competitive plane in college has been a success. These are two of the outstanding successes. We've had other successes and failures in the poverty program because we're trying to find good approaches. The whole objective of this poverty program is not the handout, which we tried in the Depression, and which worked to stimulate the economy and get us started somewhat at least. But the whole objective here is to find ways to help people help themselves. And that has to be experimental. It also involves involving the poor themselves. And this is something that's very difficult to do. For a number of reasons. First, the poor are apathetic about it. They don't know what you really mean by this. Do you really mean that we can run these things? Secondly, because the poor haven't had experiences in this sort of thing, you've got to be careful about giving them a completely free hand or trying to give them guidance and help. So there are a lot of experiments in this thing, and it is going to fail and it's going to work. And I think the successes have been such that we ought to continue to experiment in this way, and the next administration, I'm sure, especially if it's one headed by the vice president, will be discriminating and discarding the unsuccessful, continuing the successful, and maybe trying new approaches.
Senator, do you think Senator McCarthy is making a mistake in not coming out for Vice President Humphrey?
From our point of view, his request would be very helpful. From his own point of view, of course, he's, I suppose, the best judge of that. He is generating some resentment and some disillusionment. And I'm saying this not by way of any second or third-hand impressions, but this is what former McCarthy supporters are themselves saying. Because they looked to him for leadership and accepted his leadership. And now they wish that he were giving them the signal on what to do now. And the fact that he isn't becoming involved, as he told them to become involved, is disappointing some.
Do you think this could be harmful to his future political aspirations, if he has any?
Oh, that's hard to say. Politicians learn to live with the disappointments of their followers. And, you know, no politician can expect any follower to approve of him all the time. They'll measure him in terms of his total record and his total approach, and I'm sure a lot of those who may feel some disappointment will support him in the future. But what the total net picture will be, I have no idea.
If you were in his shoes today, what would you do?
Well, that's hard to imagine that I would be in his shoes. That's an awfully high posture to assume. I've always, without presuming to say what I would do in his shoes, my view has always been that you make this system work only by working at it. And you've got to work at it through your defeats as well as your victories. I suppose that's a natural view for a Democrat from Maine, because we have to start with defeats and build on victories. And so I'm a persistent, patient sort of a fellow, as you have to be in New England generally.
Do you think the McCarthy people are going to stay away from the polls purely because of his refusal to come out in favor of a Humphrey Muskie ticket?
My impression is that most of them will eventually find their way to the polls. They're not in a, and Senator McCarthy will vote, I'm sure.
You said some of them are waiting for a signal from him. I noticed that the vice chairman of the Connecticut McCarthy for President Committee was on the platform with you in Stratford this morning. Or Stanford, rather.
Yes, and Kenneth Galbraith introduced me last night at 10 o'clock to the Boston College audience and endorsed the ticket. So this is a symbol. They are moving into involvement because they're concerned about issues other than Vietnam. They're concerned about race relationships. They're concerned about our cities. They're concerned about the domestic policies which we develop after the war ends and what those policies will be in terms of our country.
You think even at this late stage of signal from Senator McCarthy would be helpful to your ticket?
Oh, yes. When you begin to generate momentum, and I think we have, anything that adds to it, you see, is cumulative and adds to the momentum. And a McCarthy endorsement at this point would add to the impression of growing unity, and there is growing unity in the party. But because he's up there so obviously in the limelight, a movement on his part would be more significant than some of the more quiet additions of McCarthy people that we're getting to our side every day.
As you have toured the country, Senator, you have consistently denounced former Governor Wallace of Alabama for spreading what you've termed fear and hatred. Now, the polls show that they vary, of course, all the way up to 20% of them vote for Governor Wallace. Don't you feel that he has some pull besides his fear and hatred approach? Don't you feel that he is somewhere or other attracting some of the votes of labor, for instance, that normally are Democratic votes?
But for that reason.
Labor. Do you think it's solely fear and hatred?
Well, labor, you see, and this is true of ethnic groups as well, which includes labor. But you see, they worked hard to build a state for themselves. From the low point of the Depression in the 30s up to the present time, labor's worked hard to build a state in a material and economic sense. And many people in labor now live in the suburbs. They become part of the middle class. And that's important to them, and it's understandable, and they want to protect them. And so they see in this unrest, stimulated by those who don't have a stake yet, they see a threat to what they've worked so hard to build. immigrants came to this country at the turn of the century, it took long years for them to build their state and to make a place for themselves in this society. Now they have. They're Americans. They're equal. And they have a full chance. They have nice homes, cars, to give their children. They feel threatened. And so it's easy for them to react to the simplistic appeal of a man who says the way now to protect that state is to build a wall between you and these others who haven't yet made it, who are somehow different kinds of people. It's an easy response to give them. To their credit, may I say, as I have discussed it in these terms with them, these groups respond in the same way that I do, that this kind of approach to building America is alien to everything America's ever stood for. You know, this sort of appeal that the Wallace uses, that the Klan uses in the South, is the sort of appeal that was directed against ethnic groups here in America, here in New England in the 20s, my own state of Maine in the 20s. We were the strangers then. We were on the outside then. We were the threat then. People like Wallace. So in the 20s, the Wallace types were attacking us. And our fathers remember it, and I remember it vaguely. I mean, that kind of doctrine of fear has never had a place in America. And it's always worked against those on the outside. And one time we were on the outside. And that message ought to be made clear. Because once you get a man like Wallace in power, you don't get him out very easily.
Do you feel that the polls are overestimating former Governor Wallace's strength?
Well, it's my hope and my belief that Americans, by and large, are uncomfortable with the kind of message he teaches, and that increasing numbers of them are going to focus on what he really stands for and reject him between now and Election Day. I may be wrong. This isn't a prediction. But judging on the basis of the responses of audiences, my own Polish-American audiences, other ethnic groups, to this basic message which I just outlined, I'd say that his support will slip. It isn't a prediction, but it's a strong feeling. And certainly for the future,